This is KPCW's Connor Thomas. It is Tuesday, the 30th of June this morning. I'm filling in for Leslie Thatcher on the local news hour. 39 degrees, pretty chilly here in Old Town Park City, and 44 in the Heber area. But it's been great to see better air quality on both the Wasatch Front and the Wasatch Back as of late. With more on your forecast for the Wasatch Back, here's ABC 4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Happy Tuesday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch Back on this Tuesday. We're going to be looking at some increasing clouds, so we'll call it partly to mostly cloudy skies at times as we go throughout today. Temperatures will still be on the somewhat cooler side as highs climb only around 70 degrees for us in Park City. We'll see those highs only in the mid to upper 70s in the Heber Valley. There is a very slim chance, we're talking a 10% chance or less, of maybe seeing an isolated pop-up shower or two, mainly those high-base showers, so not a lot of rainfall expected, but there is a chance. So we do want to mention that for you. Now, as we go into your Wednesday, look for mostly sunny to partly sunny skies. Temperatures will be in the mid to upper 70s for highs in Park City. We'll see those highs warming back into the low 80s in the Heber Valley. As we make our way into your Thursday, look for partly sunny to mostly sunny skies. Once again, temperatures climbing to around 80 degrees back towards Park City, and we should see those highs climbing into the mid 80s in the Heber Valley. As we move into your Friday, we're looking at mostly sunny skies, temperatures in the low 80s in Park City. We'll see those high temperatures climbing into the mid to upper 80s in the Heber Valley. Now, as we go towards your Thursday and a Friday, we're going to see an approaching boundary dropping in. That's going to increase the winds out of the south and southwest, and that will lead to more of that critical fire danger threat once again returning across the area. Again, not the most highest threat, but we will see that chance of that elevated to critical fire threat building back in specifically for your Thursday and a Friday. So keep that in mind. Now, as we head into the all-important holiday weekend, 4th of July Saturday, looking fantastic out there. Lots of sunshine expected. Temperatures in Park City will be climbing into the lower 80s for highs. We'll see those highs in the upper 80s in the Heber Valley. It gets even warmer for your Sunday after the 4th of July. We're looking at lots of sunshine, highs in the upper 80s in Park City. We'll see those highs in the low 90s in the Heber Valley. How about some mid-90s in the Heber Valley for your Monday with plenty of sunshine and highs nearing 90 in Park City? That's a good July's forecast for the Wasatch Back. I'm ABC 4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Coming up later on the local news hour, we'll check in with Summit County's emergency manager, Catherine McMullen, with information about fire season and lessons learned from the Parley's Canyon fire 5 years ago. Then Park City Special Events Coordinator Chris Finney will talk about 4th of July operations here in town, and the Utah Talons softball head coach Cindy Ball Malone and shortstop Hannah Flippin talk about the state's newest professional sports team. Park City Municipal is a financial supporter of KPCW. Getting into local news now, the Park City Outlet Mall Junction Commons has reduced the amount of housing it proposes to build. Formerly Outlets Park City, it has slashed 89 residential units from its redevelopment proposal. Outlets owner Singerman Real Estate, based in Chicago, would bulldoze the upper loop of stores for housing and a parking garage and fill in the lower parking lot with housing too. But the resulting mixed-use community requires a rezone and therefore buy-in from the Summit County Council. Architect Craig Elliott says the rest of the development team has worked hard to design what would now be a project where 60% of the housing is affordable.
We think that's good balance from a unit side. We've come up with a good solution to make it work financially for the project.
There would be 370 total units now, 150 for sale or rent at the market rate, and 220 affordable. That means they'd be reserved for people making at most 80% of the county's median income. That threshold could be less than that. Council members have asked for more information from the developers since 80% of the area's median income is still $134,000 for a family of four. Junction Commons hopes to be the first property granted NMU-1 or neighborhood mixed-use zoning. It's been 5 years since the county created that zoning category. The 220 affordable housing units in the landowner's proposal would count toward the council's self-imposed goal of 1,500 affordable housing units approved by 2036. Candace Hart, the current council chair, asked staff to draft some of the paperwork needed to approve or deny the development. His colleague Roger Armstrong says that's a signal that a decision could be near.
And I assume that the next meeting or the one after we are likely to take a vote. I still think there are some concerns about traffic there.
That's because the Dakota Pacific Project, which will have close to 900 homes, is just next door. And the Utah Olympic Park also has plans to build dozens of units. Transportation planner Carl Miller told the county council last week that those developments combined would not generate more traffic than Summit County is already planning for. Those plans are laid out in a document suggesting various projects between now and 2050. More information at kpcw.org and Summit County and Junction Commons are financial supporters of KPCW. Park City staff say a 6-foot sidewalk between Thanes Canyon Drive and Three Kings Drive is a better option than extending a 12-foot path. KPCW's Christine Weller has this report.
Park City cut the ribbon on a 12-foot pathway on Thanes Canyon Drive in 2025, bringing pedestrian access to the neighborhood road that previously had no sidewalks. The next phase of the project was meant to connect the multi-use path to Three Kings Drive, but during a Park City Council meeting June 25th, staff recommended a 6-foot sidewalk be installed instead. Transportation Planning Manager Julia Collins said that's because resident feedback favored a narrow, lower-impact path.
To have those pedestrians separated from the roadway, provide bicycle signage and safety awareness on the street, target roadway narrowing to accommodate that sidewalk and do traffic calming, that all improves the mitigation of neighborhood impacts.
Staff recommends installing a sidewalk along the east side of the road, as well as narrowing Three Kings in certain locations to minimize impacts to adjacent properties. Some council members and the mayor had concerns about the transition from the 12-foot path to one half its size, but appreciated that staff considered public feedback. The council gave direction to move forward with the final design process. The project is funded through Summit County and Utah Department of Transportation grants. Construction is expected to start in 2027. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
And it is 8:15 this morning on the Local News Hour. I'm Connor Thomas filling in for Leslie. On the phone now from Summit County is Emergency Manager Catherine McMullen. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
All right. So maybe by way of introduction, could you explain what an emergency manager is, what you do in your post, and why it's important?
Of course. So an emergency manager coordinates larger scale incidents, things that impact more of the population than typical operations do in public safety. And what we do is we provide coordination, right? We open up emergency operations centers, which provides coordination where incident command and our elected officials and all the different departments within public safety can come together to solve issues during incidents. So emergency managers lead those efforts by coordinating, bringing people together. When an incident has gone beyond what our current resource capabilities are, we can bring resources in from other regions, from the state, from the federal level. And then we work on sheltering, response recovery. We move that incident into the recovery to support our residents. We lead like I mentioned, sheltering, we lead any recovery efforts that may need to happen, whether it's damage assessments, whether it is coordinating insurance companies with our residents, things like that. So larger scale incidents, coordination, bringing resources. We're also responsible for emergency alerts during incidents as an integrated public alert and warning system authorized disseminator. We do the notifications.
And obviously this year, fire is the thing on everyone's mind right now. But what other incidents fall under that umbrella that you mentioned?
Really, any incidents that meet those qualifications, right? Any incidents that's reaching beyond the scope of what we can do in an operational period can go to emergency management. Examples of that would be flooding, earthquakes, major storms, power outages, anything that is taking our county out of steady state and regular operations can go to emergency management. If it needs coordination and if it needs resources, it can go to the EOC.
Well, I definitely do want to talk about fire this morning. What are you and your office and colleagues doing this year, and what makes it different?
Well, I think First of all, Summit County is very active with wildfire preparations 100% of the year, 24 hours a day. We are coordinating throughout the year to make sure that we are mitigating, right? We're doing those projects that reduces our risk for wildfire. We have our Summit County Fuels Committees that meet every month. Our wildland fire groups meet regularly. Our regular fire districts meet regularly. All of our public safety agencies coordinate with that in mind. Summit County is what we call 100% in the wildland-urban interface. So we really don't have a downtime when it comes to wildland fire. So we prepare regularly for fire, and we are, so some of the things that we're doing, well, you mentioned what's different about this year. Of course, it's our drier winter that we had. Typically, we get a lot of snowfall, as you know, a lot of moisture, and everybody's acutely aware that we have had very little moisture over the winter, a lot less than we typically get. So that can create a larger incident if we have a wildland fire. Now, something that can be positive about that is actually we got less moisture, so our cheatgrasses didn't grow as tall, right? They're a little bit smaller this year. They're 8 or 10 inches tall, and some of it's even still green because we're getting some intermittent moisture. But we are absolutely aware that we have less water in the reservoirs. We have less water available to fight the fires. And certain areas of our county are much drier. So that's what's making it a little bit different this year.
Can you say more about that and which areas you see the most risk in? I'd imagine the high Uintas wilderness have some of the highest moisture and so don't have that much risk.
That's true, but they can also have more beetle kill and other issues, right? We go out all the time and we do what we call pile burning when we're doing prescribed fires to try to thin some of that forest and reduce the risk to our communities. I try not to point out any specific communities that I say, this one is really high at risk, because I would hate for anybody's insurance to be listening and saying, hey, Summit County just called out this one community as being very high risk. We all should have a heightened sense of awareness. And I think that what makes some communities more at risk than others would be if they're not actively hardening their perimeters, working on their homes and making sure that the fuels don't come up right up to them and using those offsets. They're 30 to 60 feet away from my home. So if a fire does burn through, I have less risk of it burning down my home. So I would say the communities that are most at risk are those without active HOAs and communities that are working to make sure that the landscape is clean, the brush is cleared out, the defensible perimeters, as what we like to call them, are established for the community areas and the homes. Those are going to be at less of a risk than other communities which don't go to those efforts or don't support those efforts in their area.
And going back to what you mentioned about your preparation process and that, I suppose, 24/7, 365 aspect of it, it does sound like a lot of meetings. What are you discussing in meetings with people? Are you ordering materials or equipment? Are you game planning things? Could you kind of take us behind the scenes?
Sure. In emergency management, 90% of it is meetings and coordination, planning and preparedness, right? We only spend 5 to 10% of our time in active incidents, although in some, sometimes that can be a little bit more than that. But during those meetings, the coordination is what's important, right? When we sit down and we have these meetings and we discuss our preparations, we're discussing what we're able to do, what gaps we may have, and then we are ordering equipment, ordering teams, beefing up staff to make sure that we have teams available to support. I know that all the fire districts have increased their staffing capabilities to deal with wildland fire, establishing dedicated teams to do that. Summit County has another team to add support to the fire district's teams. So we are continually building staff. People are who respond to these, and they come with a certain amount of equipment, whether you're building a type 3 team or a type 6 team, right? That's going to be different types of brush trucks and things like that. And every fire district could speak individually to what they can do. But all across our region, we call it Region 2, and that's Wasatch County, Salt Lake County, Utah County. We're all building those capabilities. And then when we go to meet, we sit down and go, hey, look at this resource that we built. Can that be shared? Can that be deployed to your county? Can we reach out and help each other? And that's what we do during incidents. And that coordination is really valuable. We also may sit and talk about, like you mentioned, there's communities with limited egress or we can't get in and out as easily. So how do we mitigate that? How do we make sure that we can get those residents out safely? So those are the types of conversations we have. Everyone is building staffing capabilities and different, making sure that the equipment is running and up to date and tested. And all of those things are what's happening during those conversations.
Yeah, and you kind of got to it at the end of that answer. You know, how does your preparation process start to interface with everyday residents? And what can residents do to stay prepared themselves, even while officials are having these meetings in the background?
Absolutely. Well, again, we can go back to look at your property, make sure that it has a defensible perimeter, make sure that fuels for fire aren't leaning up against your home. Your wood pile isn't stacked at your home. A tree that's overhanging can cause those issues. So having inspections done or looking that with a good eye yourself to say, how can my house be protected from fire is a big first step. If you need support for that, you can contact your local fire district and they're happy to come out and advise when they have that ability. You can also make sure that you have your go bags ready to go, your evacuation bag. And there's lots of resources online that you can look up to say, what do I put in my evacuation bag? But what I would encourage you to do is think about, if I evacuate, if I have to evacuate, where am I going? Am I going to go to a family member's house? Am I going to go to a hotel? Am I going to go to a shelter? And then you build your go bag with that, what you need to do that, to carry out that plan. That can help it from getting to be too large of a kit or too extensive, versus I'm not going to go camp out, so I don't necessarily need a camping bag, but I do need toothbrushes and extra clothes and diapers and things of that nature. Now, when you make your go bag, another important item to consider is actually your important documents. Do you have a USB that has all your insurance papers on it, images of valuables from your home that you're going to need if we did lose a home, if your home was burned down? You're going to need that information to rebuild, to submit your insurance claims, to come to a disaster assistance center and get support that you may need. You need those documents. And then the other part of that is actually your pets, right? We always encourage you to bring your pets when we evacuate. And we have three stages of evacuation. So be aware of the alerts that you're getting. And we can talk about alerts in a moment. But when you get the alert that says get ready to evacuate, make sure you know where your pets are, right? They're gathered in if they're small domesticated pets. Where are they? Are they in the house? I don't need to go hunt for them. Then when you get the set evacuation, Summit County applies to a ready, set, go. So if we have the time, we're going to give you, hey, be ready to evacuate because this could happen. And then the set is, okay, this is probably imminent and it's within the next hour, so we're going to evacuate you. And now you're gathering your cat, your dog, you're putting them in a kennel by the door because animals get frightened in fire and they can hide and they can run off. And by the time we say go, it's time to go right now. Or by the time someone knocks on your door and says we're evacuating, there usually is not time to run and find a cat that's hiding or find an animal that was on the loose in the neighborhood. So those are the types of things you're going to do. Have your kits ready. Make a short list of things that you can't pack in your kit all the time, like an animal or like medicines that you use on a regular basis. And gather those things as you're getting those alert, leaning into, I'm not sure we're going to evacuate, but I'm ready to go if we are, and my pets will be safe and I can bring them with you. And if you have large animals, you, of course, need to make additional arrangements, and we'll have resources. And our community is great at coming out to say who needs assistance with trailers and getting large animals out as well.
Yeah, and we have seen how important the being prepared is, because Eureka, for example, has now evacuated twice due to the wildfires southwest of here. So how will people know when an evacuation is in place? You've talked about alerts, people knocking on their doors. I mean, they can listen to the radio, of course, but what are the various channels that you'll work to get the word out?
So we have varying levels of alerts. If you you can sign up for optional alerts if you text SC Fire to 91896, we're going to give you the optional alerts. Those are things, not necessarily life safety, but they're like, be aware, there's a fire in the area, you're going to see smoke from this other area. So those are going to be optional alerts about fires in the area. And then go to Summit Alerts to sign up and make sure that your accurate information is in there. When we send an alert that's going to go to cell phones and radios and things of that nature, you can go in and customize and say, I have these different phones. I want you to alert all of them. And you can prioritize in what order you want those phones to be alerted. You can also say, I'd like an email. Those you can specify if it's a landline or a cell phone and that you can receive text versus voice calls. So it's really imperative as residents of Summit County, go to Summit Alerts and make sure that your contact information is updated. Now, with that being said, we use what I called our IPAWS system, Integrated Public Alert and Warning System. It does allow me to go into a map and circle a geographic area, create a polygon, and reach all the cell phones within those repeaters within those towers. And that's accurate about 80-85% of the time. I know that seems like a large variance. The technology is getting better all the time, but when you travel between cell towers and things of that nature, it can change which ones you're receiving. So it's getting more and more accurate every day. But if you've gone into Summit Alerts and customized that, we're going to guarantee accuracy. So having those alerts updated, opting into SE Fire for optional alerts. And then, of course, as you mentioned, listen to the radio, turn on your TVs, watch the news, go to social media. We have a very strong communications department in Summit County and at the sheriff's office. And those public information officers are going to be pushing a lot of information out through their channels. So while we're going to be doing everything we can to get to you, we need you to make that dual effort to really come find the information. And then when everything else is happening, we have an amazing search and rescue team in Summit County that typically deploys to these, and we will knock doors. If there is a community that's being evacuated and we have that time, we send teams in to physically knock doors to make sure that each home is cleared.
And correct me if I'm wrong, you were emergency manager 5 years ago when Parley's Canyon caught on fire. Yeah. And the flames traveled up towards Summit Park and triggered evacuations in the Pine Brook area. How did the evacuations work in that specific instance?
Well, you know, we learned a lot from that fire. They did work. We've worked on improving or reducing the time it takes to get the alert out. It's fairly complicated method to get that information from incident command out to the general public, right? The messaging has to be absolutely precise. We have to know the exact addresses that are being evacuated and use the proper channels. So that can take a few minutes, and we've been working many years. Every community in Utah is working on reducing the time that it takes to get that message alert out. So we've been working to refine that. Another lesson we learned from Parley's Canyon fire is sometimes when you don't have any information, you don't distribute. We don't want to over-message people, right? They're seeking good information, but you don't want to send a lot of information if you don't have any. So we released information when we had it, but that sometimes left people saying, I was constantly digging to find out what the updated status was, and I didn't know when I was going to hear it. And so since then, we've adopted methods where during incidents, we say we will send out updated information in 2 hours. We will give you an update at this time, even if that message is there's no new information at that time. At least you know where to go to find it and what time it will be released, so you don't have to spend your day, even though you may do that anyways, but you don't have to spend your whole day digging for information worried that you missed it. So we've established timelines for the release of the information. We've enhanced our communication capabilities within the county and within the public safety agencies. They're very well coordinated. We've developed processes for what we call our joint information centers to make sure that information is distributed as quickly as possible. We've also updated our sheltering methods. We're seeing that sheltering is evolving, right? During the Parley's Canyon fire, we had about 25 people come to our shelter that was set up to get information. Only about 9 stayed for longer than an hour, and only 1 individual stayed overnight. So now we look at that and say, when we had 8,000 people evacuated and 1 person stay overnight, maybe we need some redundancies or some other options. We want to have options where people can bring their pets, where if they need that. But what does that look like? Maybe that looks like partnerships with Airbnb or short-term rentals, where people can go utilize a short-term rental versus staying in a cot in a high school. So we've expanded the options that we have based on the need of our community when we have an incident like that. And those were all lessons learned from that Parley's Canyon fire.
Yeah, when you're doing the cost benefit, I guess, of evacuations and deciding to make that call, is it just proximity of the flames, or are there other factors that you're taking into account?
Well, when it comes to building the shelter, what type, is that what you mean? Like, how do we decide type? Is it a cost consideration?
No, sorry. Making the call about evacuating a neighborhood. You know, is it just based on how close a fire is to that neighborhood?
No, there's a lot of factors into that, and an incident commander would be much more suited to answer that question specifically. But typically what they're looking at is, the, like you said, proximity, but they're also looking at wind direction, the speed of the fire, the fuels that are surrounding it, how fast is it going to move through those fuels? Are they slow-burning fuels or quick-burning fuels? And there's just, it is a highly complex consideration to make when they determine that evacuation is needed, and the sheriff ultimately makes that call, and they work tightly with our fire commanders on those decisions. But it's a complex analysis to say it's time to go, and when it, you know, if there's not that time for a lot of complex, sometimes it's done on the spot just to say it's way too close and we're going to go now.
All right. We've been speaking with Catherine McMullen. She's Summit County's emergency manager. Anything else that you want to get out there before we go?
No, I think you covered it. I think just make sure that people get signed up for some alerts and are opting into that information, because we're going to be working actively to get you information, and it just helps us if you've sought it from us and made sure that we have up-to-date information. And then make sure that your go bags are ready, so that when it is time to evacuate, we don't jeopardize any of our public safety responders by delaying our evacuation. We want to make sure everybody's safe, all your animals are safe, and that our public safety responders are safe.
All right. Thank you for your work, especially this year.
Thank you.
And in studio with me is Chris Finney. He's the special events coordinator for Park City. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
And happy early 4th of July. That's what we're here to talk about. It's a logistical feat in Park City annually. You know, what have you been doing to prepare, you know, closures, traffic flow, that type of thing?
Yeah, so we have a fun week. Honestly, it starts even if you want to say today. So we have some concerts this week. Noches de Verano is at Cell City Park tonight. Tomorrow on July 1st, on Wednesday, we have the Park City Farmers Market over at Park City Mountain. And then it rolls into a nice fun weekend. We have Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at the Canyons. They have Forum Fest. That's 4 p.m. to 10. A lot of activities, bands, food. And then it ends with a drone show at night. So again, that's the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th. For us on Saturday, we've been planning a whole day of fun on Saturday, July 4th. Starting at 8 a.m., we have a 5K fun run with the Park City Ski and Snowboard Club that starts and finishes over there at Park City Mountain. 9 a.m., we have a Rodney Shurer's Fallen Officer Memorial that's here on Main Street at the Shurer's Plaza. That's pretty moving. If you come out, we have a bunch of officers, and they're doing a memorial. We have some that sing the national anthem. It's pretty moving. It's nice. From 11 o'clock is when the parade starts. So you'll see all the parades. Parade runs from about 11 to about 1 o'clock. Hopefully we'll have the road back open at around 2 o'clock. And then again, from 12:30 to 5 down at City Park, we have food trucks, rugby, music. That's sort of our little Forum Fest down there at City Park. And then 10 p.m., we'll have our own drone show in town. That takes off from Park City Mountain, and you can see it from pretty much anywhere here in Old Town.
Yeah. Will there be any fireworks shows in Park City this year? Are there any licensed allowed?
No fireworks this year. It's actually Governor Cox just kind of put the squash on any fireworks this year from the high fire danger. But if you want, I have a little bit more city operations. So you mentioned some road closures. Main Street and Sweet Alley will close on Saturday morning at 6 a.m. Kind of a soft closure. Obviously, we'll get all of our floats in on Sweet Alley. If you need to run and get something quickly off of Main Street, that's fine. And then by Park Ave, we'll do the same thing, but at 8 a.m. And then the whole Main Street and parade route, which is Main Street down to Park Ave. So starting at the top of Main Street by the Brew Pub, goes all the way down past the 7-Eleven into the intersection on Deer Valley Drive is the whole parade route. Everything goes on lockdown at 10 a.m., so that whole area will be shut down with police cars and other safety measures to make sure no one can drive on the street. That's at 10 a.m., and then We're trying for a flyover this year. Hill Air Force Base has said that they won't be doing any flyovers, but we won't know until this week. So we have a few calls out. Hopefully we can get that. And then the parade starts promptly at 11.
All right. So are you taking volunteers if there are people with planes listening?
Maybe, yeah. Give me a call at the city. Chris Finney, special events.
All right. So the parade is the main event. How many people are you expecting this year?
You know, we have about 71 floats right now, and last year we had about an estimate of about 50,000 people in town.
So, you know, what's your goal with, like, you know, some of the road closures and traffic patterns? What are you just trying to get those people around the best that you can? Can it be perfect ever?
You know what? We definitely have transit as a priority, and we have a great free transit system and a bunch of satellite parking lots. So really the best thing to do would be to come in. We'll have our VMS boards, our messaging boards, directing you to what satellite lot is best. But if you're coming in off of 40, you know, it's good just to park at Richardson Flat. We have a 20-minute frequency and a free bus that'll bring you right into Old Town, the Old Town Transit Center. Otherwise, you know, bus transit is good from any of your neighborhoods. We also have satellite parking lots at Park City Mountain, Deer Valley, and the high school. So you can catch a bus from any of those. If you do drive in, all of the surface lots on Sweet Alley will be closed for parade and float staging. So we do ask you to enter and exit from the top on Marsac for China Bridge. And China Bridge, if you do drive in, with transit being our priority, we have a $30 flat fee in China Bridge. That'll go from 7 a.m. to 1 p.m. And parking after 1 p.m. in China Bridge will be free for the rest of the night.
All right. Will you be having that special bus-only lane on Deer Valley Drive?
Yeah, thanks for mentioning that. We will be, again, with transit as a priority, we'll be taking a lane on the southbound, so the most western lane on Deer Valley Drive will be shut down for parade floats, buses, and emergency vehicles only. So if you're on the bus, you'll be able to scoot right past all that other traffic.
I've always been curious, who gives out the awards for floats at the end of the day?
You know, we have some judges that are along the parade route, and they get together and they will vote together and give out the awards.
How do I become a judge?
Give me a call. We are always looking for volunteers.
Okay. And anything special this year? It is the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. Anything special related to that?
Yeah, so we've been working with the Utah chapter for America 250. You'll see some banners that'll be set up, so we definitely have some marketing ideas and some copyright things that we've gotten from that organization. But their programs really this year are to get out and try to volunteer. So if you would like to come out and try to do something with the parade, or if you see anything else, you could volunteer. They have America's Potluck. So really what they're trying to do is have anyone come out and just get together with your neighbors, have a little block party or a barbecue and get to know your neighbors a little bit. And then some storytelling. So maybe, you know, come sit on my knee, I'll tell you about my Park City back in 1995, or you can, you know, tell stories about the mining community here in town. So you'll see some of those activities, but for us, you'll see some extra banners hung up for the America 250, and it's just sort of the spirit of it.
Any gathering at City Park like we see on Miner's Day?
Exactly. So we'll be in North City Park this year. So from 12:30 to 5, there'll be rugby games, bands, food trucks, face painting, a lot of activities out there to have some fun with.
We'll get to see the Mine Community Center progress. How's that going?
It's going well. It looks like we're ahead of schedule. I think the weather over the winter was definitely helpful. It looks beautiful. So, yeah, come down and check that out as well. It's going to be great when that opens.
All right. Anything else that people should know ahead of the 4th this weekend?
I'd just like to add that, you know, I'd like to thank all the city departments first off. It takes more than just myself and my department. So there's police and streets and transportation planning and transit, and we all get together for this great day. I'd also just like to mention that it's Saturday. The 4th of July is a Saturday. It's going to bring a lot of crowds to town. So just give yourself a little extra time. Like I said, take the bus. If you have to drive in, give yourself some extra time. Know there'll be traffic. Stay cool. This is a great day in Park City. Just come and have some fun and have a good attitude.
All right, Chris Finney, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks a lot.
A home builder says market forces make residential development in Browns Canyon all but inevitable. Ivory Homes recently showed Eastern Summit County Planning Commissioners an advertisement from a 1970s edition of the Salt Lake Tribune, reading, "Look closely, this is a treasure map." The treasure was not silver, it was real estate. Now, the Garf and Rogers families are looking to develop some of their Browns Canyon holdings with as many as 3,000 homes over time. The families have long thought of the ranch as an investment as well, says Ivory Development President Chris Gambrulis.
We're coming to the fruition of what they were advertising in the 70s.
The old ad cites the booming recreation industry in Utah's Summit County and the forthcoming Jordan L. Reservoir as reasons to invest in Browns Canyon.
You know, in this area, you've got all these 40, 60, 80 acre parcels. These were all parceled off and subdivided by the Garf and Rogers families starting in the 70s. It is how they paid off their note on the larger piece. They purchased 15,000 acres. They have about 7,000 roughly left.
But it's still mostly cows and zoned as such. Ivory's in the process of negotiating a rezone with Summit County on the family's behalf. Eastern Summit County Planning Commissioners have found the process unorthodox so far. Ivory first wants Summit County to create a new zoning category for Browns Canyon. If that's approved, the developer would ask for that zoning on about 600 acres. And only after that would Ivory then be able to apply again for building approvals. Planning Commissioner Alex Peterson wants to make sure the developer, the public, and the commission that he chairs are all on the same page.
We got a horse and a cart here. And I understand if we're looking at it, you got to look at the horse and the cart together. As I understand it, first we're being asked whether we want to approve a new process.
The public hearing on Ivory's proposal, initially scheduled for Thursday, has been canceled, but the item is still on the agenda for a discussion after other business starting at 6 p.m. There will be public hearings in the future at both the Planning Commission and Summit County Council, which has the final say. You're listening to KPCW Park City. Local crews and volunteers are urgently removing garlic mustard, a noxious weed covering around 12,000 acres in Summit County. KPCW's Christine Weller reports the abnormal winter has shortened the pulling season.
On a sunny Saturday morning, Sarah Jo Dickens, her team, and a handful of volunteers hiked into the forest next to Park City's Armstrong Trail. They followed white tape through the trees and bushes, making their way to a spot where the forest floor was blanketed in green vegetation. To the untrained eye, nothing looks amiss. But the group knows the plants are garlic mustard, noxious weeds that spread so quickly they displace native plants.
Garlic mustard in particular is capable of suppressing other seeds from germinating. So once it's established, you see fewer and fewer natives until you see none.
Dickens is an ecologist who leads the Summit Cooperative Weed Management Area, a nonprofit focused on controlling noxious weeds in Summit County. She said garlic mustard is an especially dangerous plant as it secretes a chemical that suppresses the microbial nutrients in soil that help prevent diseases in native plants. Dickens said if the noxious weed takes over, the forest is much more vulnerable, and more dead trees mean increased wildfire risk. Equipped with blue plastic bags, Dickens and her helpers hand-pulled the weeds near Armstrong Trail to control the spread of garlic mustard. Dickens said the situation is more pressing this year. The wet October and unseasonably warm winter, which had multiple cycles of snow and melting, have allowed more seeds to germinate. The warm weather also shifted the pulling season, which usually spans April to August.
This year it started in May, and it will probably be burnt out, so dead, by mid-July. So our window to take care of this problem is super short, which makes all work for it incredibly urgent.
But no matter the year, she says, there's too much garlic mustard to tackle. The cooperative has mapped about 600 acres of the noxious weed in Summit County, but estimates it's growing on around 1,200 acres. To prevent the weed from spreading, the cooperative first pulls patches on the outskirts of the county, as well as those by trails and streams. That's where the Garlic Mustard Games comes into play. The annual competition was created to cover more ground and help educate locals on the harms of the plant. Participants earn prizes for pulling the noxious weed. Volunteer Allison Kerstead joined the Garlic Mustard Games about 3 years ago. She said she didn't want to compete at first, just to volunteer. But after being convinced to join in on the fun and learning that weighing the weeds helps the cooperative get grants, she entered and won the competition 2 years in a row.
The funny thing last year was Sarah Jo found this new patch that hadn't been addressed in a year or two, and the weeds were like literally like 4 or 5 feet tall. And I just went in there on a couple afternoons and I could just grab handfuls. And so I think that's what did it.
Kerstad is one of the most consistent pullers, collecting hundreds of pounds of the noxious weeds and often pulling outside of games events with the company of her dog. She said the activity checks all the boxes. It's relaxing, satisfying, and provides a sense of community. Jen Heineman said she's a self-taught noxious weed hater who's been pulling all kinds of invasive plants since the 1990s. Her favorite part of the garlic mustard games is the company.
It's often a lot of girls, and we chat and we laugh while we're pulling, and I just love that. I just love that, the camaraderie of that.
Dickens said there are only a couple of weeks left to pull garlic mustard this season. Soon the plants will produce seed pods and start changing color. Once the plants turn tan, they can't be pulled.
Those pods are so brittle that if you barely touch them, they can break open and those seeds will get on your clothes or on your equipment and you accidentally bring them somewhere else.
During the event Saturday, 10 volunteers pulled over 300 pounds of garlic mustard. The cooperative's Nate Butterfield said typically the weeds would have to be hauled out of the forest to prevent reseeding. But this time, the team is testing a new technique. Fire crews will add other material to the piles and burn them as part of wildfire prevention work. Dickens said her team first found the 60-acre patch of garlic mustard near Armstrong Trail in 2016. To some, it still looks overgrown, but she said it's improved immensely. The sheer volume of the noxious weed in the county can be intimidating, Dickens said, but consistency is key. That's why her team and volunteers come back year after year to pull. Dickens said a secret weapon is also coming. For almost 30 years, scientists have been working on creating a biological control agent that will attack garlic mustard, but not native plants. Dickens said a weevil was recently approved for use.
Not only is it going to help turn the table, but we don't have to use as much herbicide. We can release these bugs, and over a 4 to 6 year period, they may be able to reduce it by like 30 or 40%.
Dickens said it will take 4 to 5 years before Summit County can get the bugs, but the development is encouraging. In the meantime, she will continue efforts to stop the spread of garlic mustard and save area forests. For the next 2 weeks or so, locals can help by pulling the weeds on their own property or by adding to trailside pull stations. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
On the phone now from the Utah Talons softball team, we have Coach Cindy Ball Malone and shortstop Hannah Flippin. Thank you both for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.
All right. So the Talons, for those that don't know, are Utah's newest professional sports team. When did you form, and what have you been seeing from Utahns visiting so far?
This is our inaugural season as the Utah Talons, but our first year as the Talons was last year. So last year we did a touring model where we toured 10 different cities and came here to Utah, and the turnout was great. And so they decided that Utah deserved a pro softball team. And so here we are, our first year as the Utah Talons.
Yeah, so I've read that there are 6 teams in the Athletes Unlimited Softball League. It's the AUSL that you play in each summer going forward. You know, I'm curious, reading about 6 teams, what's the camaraderie like in the league right now, and it's as it's sort of in its nascent stages? Hannah, maybe.
Yeah, the camaraderie's been great. I think right now the mission is to grow softball, and as much as we want to duke it out with each other and beat up on each other, the overall goal is to create a sustainable league, and I think that's what we're doing. And the turnout has been great. The viewership has been great, and so we're trending in the right direction.
Yeah, and Coach Ball Malone, your team is 10-4 right now, and I take it that's the best in the league right now. What has this season been like so far, and what's ahead as far as playoffs, the title?
Yeah, well, we are reigning champs from last season. So, you know, this is my first year with the team, and their goal and mission is to, you know, get that championship again. So being on top of the league, it is the standard for this team. And we want to separate ourselves even more moving forward. But again, just like Hannah said, you know, we have a couple of missions here. One is to grow the game of softball, and the Talons want to be on top while we're growing the game of softball.
Yeah. You know, what have you seen as far as a response from fans in Utah? I was reading on AUSL's Instagram, actually, that there's been a more than doubling of viewership on ESPN platforms of the league. Has that translated to ticket sales at all?
Yeah, it's definitely showed up in our stadium at our games. The fans have showed up for all of our home games, and they're into the game. We have some team chants and team cheers that they are super into, and they've been super engaged. We are so lucky to have such a supportive fan base, and excited to bring a championship back to them again this year.
Yeah, and it's difficult right now in the country with the business of women's sports. And can you talk about why it's important to grow the game as it relates to, you know, wage parity between, you know, softball and baseball?
I mean, softball is trending right now, and women's sports are trending. And so I think people are seeing that now, and we're definitely rolling off of the back of some great college athletes and what the college game is doing right now. We're in a really good position to keep trending that way. And that's the overall goal of this league, is to be like the WNBA, be like the NWSL, who have fought for to lessen the wage gap. And we're just following their footsteps. They've had great models and just trying to be like them.
Yeah, and I gather, Hannah, that you play at the U of U softball stadium, which is not a very short walk from where you were before in your college career. Is it nice kind of still being on home turf?
Oh, yeah. It's like a dream come true playing at my alma mater. I feel so lucky. There's only three girls in the league that are playing at their alma maters. And so one for it to be Utah, two for it to be my alma mater. I feel super lucky. And then the fan base in the community has just showed up, and I'm so proud to be a Utah U alum.
I was reading we're about halfway through the season. When is your next game or series and your next home game and series?
Yeah, we play tonight against the Volts. Oh, sorry. We play tonight against the Volts at 7 p.m. And then another game tomorrow at 6 p.m. And then our last two home games will be on Friday and Saturday. And then that would be the finish of our homestand here.
Yeah. Coach, have you, you know, it is early stages for the AUSL, but have you developed any rivalries that we should be aware of with any particular teams?
I think that question probably needs to go towards Hannah a little bit more, because when we're on the field, you know, we talk about growing the game, but then when you get these women on the field, they're athletes, they're competitors, they want to win. So any team that's opposing us is a rivalry in my brain, but maybe Hannah's got more of a specific team in mind.
Yeah, we played against the Bandits in the championship last year, and so I think there's a little bit of an unspoken rivalry there. And then the Blaze, we just played the Carolina Blaze in a series, and they took the series from us, and so we have a little chip on our shoulder from that. So they can be expecting some of our best softball when it comes back around to us playing them.
All right. You know, it was interesting to hear that Utah was kind of a test market for the league when it was doing the touring model. Why do you think softball proved to be so popular in Salt Lake?
I think that it's just trending all over the country right now, and the softball community loves softball. The Utah community loves softball. There's camps everywhere. There's new facilities. There's new teams. And it's just growing as a sport here in Utah. And so they showed up for our four games last year. The stadium was packed. There was not an open seat in the place. And so I truly believe that the Salt Lake community and the Utah community earned to have a pro softball team here in Utah. They showed up and they said, we want this team to be our home team. And so that's what they get. They're rewarded with great viewership, a great community, and a great softball team now.
All right. Well, we'll be watching. For those that can't make the upcoming games tonight and tomorrow, Coach, where can softball be watched on TV or streamed right now?
Yeah, we're on ESPN tonight, but typically it's ESPN, MLB, or CBS Sports. So you can watch if you can't make it. But I just want to piggyback off of what Hannah had mentioned, that you know, viewership across the nation has been great for our league. And then I think we are very unique and special in that our hometown community, it's such an intimate setting. The fans have, we have tradition already just in our first year. We have, you know, our own cheers, our own chants. The fans like have this great unique relationship with our own athletes. And across the board, there's such great viewership. The markets are amazing. But I'm going to have to say that we are number one when it comes to really cheering on their own hometown team. And so I just want to thank the entire community here of welcoming us and making us feel so at home in such a short time.
All right, and that's where we've got to leave it. Coach Cindy Ball Malone and shortstop Hannah Flippin of the Utah Talons, thank you for being here.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you.